From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.
My fellow Americans, on Saturday, at my direction, the United States successfully concluded an airstrike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that killed the emir of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri.
President Biden last night formally announcing details of the U.S. drone attack that killed the leader of al-Qaeda. Ayman al-Zawahiri's death is the most significant blow to the terrorist organization since the killing of his partner and predecessor Osama bin Laden 11 years ago. What does it mean, and why was he in Afghanistan? David Petraeus, the former commander of U.S. Central Command and former director of the CIA in the Obama administration, is here. General, welcome back, and your reaction.
Well, it's a very significant attack. As you noted, he has been the leader, the emir of al-Qaeda, since Osama bin Laden was killed. He was long seen as the brains behind many of the most sensational attacks. That was his specialty, and they included, as the president noted last night, the East Africa embassy bombings, the bombing of the U.S. destroyer in Yemen, and also, of course, the 9/11 attacks. So this is, again, very, very significant, but it's also significant in that it shows that the Taliban have not lived up to the Doha Agreement and their public commitments to not allow international extremists to have safe harbor in the country that they now control. So it means that we have to continue this focus. We have demonstrated by this attack that we can indeed, as many of us predicted we could, conduct over-the-horizon operations. But it also reminds us how challenging that is if you're operating from bases well outside of Afghanistan with slow-moving drones that have to use a lot of their blade time going to and from the target over which they're generally focused.
Yeah, these over-the-horizon tactics are, you know, fighting terrorism from afar. And as you said, al-Zawahiri was found in a wealthy neighborhood in Afghanistan. The Taliban promised in the Doha Agreement not to allow terrorists like al-Qaeda a safe haven. What if they are?
Well, they clearly are. And then the other worrisome, because again, keep in mind, this individual was in a safe house, we believe, that was provided by the number two in the overarching Taliban regime, Shiraz Haqqani, who, by the way, has a $10 million reward for information leading to his arrest as well, and is responsible for a number of very serious attacks himself. So the fact that the Taliban regime is not just tolerating, but hosting the leader of al-Qaeda and the most important al-Qaeda leader other than Osama bin Laden is very, very significant. Moreover, there's a real worry that the Islamic State is actually the more active extremist element in Afghanistan, taking advantage of the situation in the wake of the toppling of the government and the Taliban taking control. They're carrying out a number of attacks in the country. They've established quite a capability. And of course, they are the most recent, really serious extremist international threat, at least up until, of course, their caliphate was eliminated in northern Iraq and northeastern Syria. So they have a new group there, the Khorasan group, it's called, of the Islamic State. And we have to keep a very close eye and pressure on them as well. And all of that takes a considerable amount of resources, given that we no longer have bases in Afghanistan.
That's right. Well, we only have about a minute and a half with you. You mentioned IS, the Islamic State. You mentioned, you know, of course, al-Qaeda threats, as we're hearing from you. But I've wondered what you think, because now the U.S. is also confronting a Russia that interferes with our elections and blatantly launches what sure feels like a genocidal war. White supremacists and average citizens at home, you know, ginned up on lies about an election, attacking the Capitol. Where do you think the biggest security threats lie?
Well, the pacing threat, as it has been described by our Secretary of Defense, clearly is the competition with China, termed by our national security advisor, severe competition. Of course, that's heightened right now by Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. But I think the distinguishing feature of the current times actually is the number of challenges and the complexity of those challenges. Never before have we had to keep so many significant plates spinning, to use the metaphorical image of the guy in the circus who gets plates on a stick and then has to keep moving around to keep them spinning, noting that, of course, we have allies and partners uniquely to help us with this. But that number of plates and the significance of many of them, I don't think has ever been greater than it is right now.
David Petraeus, former commander of U.S. Central Command, former director of the CIA during the Obama administration. Thank you so much for weighing in today.
Great to be with you, Robin. Thank you.
Voters in five states are at the polls today for statewide primaries. Among the key issues, abortion and the 2020 election. And today's results will surely give us some early signals before the midterms this fall. Domenico Montanaro is NPR senior political editor and correspondent, and he's in the studio next to me. Domenico, good to see you.
Thank you for having me, and good to see you, too, in person.
We meet. I feel like I've known you forever. Okay, Donald Trump, the former president, is backing several Republicans who are also election deniers as far as the 2020 results. But let's start with a governor's race in Arizona. Who's on the ballot?
Sure. Well, first of all, we know Biden won this state narrowly in 2020, which was proven by a statewide audit. Nevertheless, Trump has made the election lies that he's clinging to a litmus test for almost all of the people that he's endorsed. Mm. His candidate for governor here is Carrie Lake. She's gone full bore on the election lies. She's been peddling Trump's lies and railing against the media, despite, by the way, being a former local TV news anchor herself. She's running against Karen Taylor Robson, a real estate developer. She's a former GOP donor, former member of the State Board of Regents, and she has ties to the outgoing governor, Doug Ducey. He's endorsed her, as has former Vice President Mike Pence. So this has turned into something of a proxy battle between Trump and Pence. But showing you just how much Trump and his election lies matter in this, Taylor Robson isn't exactly a beacon of standing up for the election that happened in 2020. She hasn't said fraud happened, but she's called the 2020 election unfair and won't commit to certifying the next election.
Mm. Okay, well, there's that. And then let's talk about the races for Senate seat in Arizona and Secretary of State in Arizona.
Yeah, it's a hugely key Senate race because it's to take on Democrat Mark Kelly, which could, you know, be one of those states that decides control of the Senate since we're at 50-50. The favorite on the Republican side is a man named Blake Masters. He's a venture capitalist, leads by a wide margin in the polls. He's ahead of businessman Jim Lehman and the state attorney general Mark Brnovich. Trump has endorsed Masters and made it about the 2020 election, what else, right, as he has for most of the other candidates. And Masters says he thinks Trump won, which of course is false. Masters has a huge backing here. It's interesting, from billionaire Peter Thiel, who founded PayPal. Masters considers a friend and mentor. He's poured millions of his own money in to support Masters. Masters has been very Trump-like on immigration in particular, huge issue in the border state of Arizona. In the Secretary of State's race, real eyebrow raiser here because a Trump-backed conspiracy theorist in Mark Finchem is on the cusp of potentially controlling the state's election administration. He'd be the sixth, by the way, election denier to win the GOP nomination for a Secretary of State race. If he does, it would include key states like Michigan, New Mexico, Nevada. And, you know, people, we have to remember, are the institutions. It held by a thread in 2020, and we're seeing a lurch more toward the kind of people who align with Trump.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the 2020 election, three GOP members in the U.S. House of Representatives who voted to impeach the president for his role on January 6th are on today's primary ballot, and that includes Peter Meyer in Michigan. Mm-hmm. What are his odds?
Yeah, so Peter Meyer in Michigan, as well as Dan Newhouse and Jimmy Herrera Butler, who are in Washington State, the three of them are three of the 10 Republicans who I'll call Trump impeachers. And they had gone against Trump. Trump has taken aim at them. And if they lose, there would only be potentially one person who voted for Trump's impeachment who would have survived their primary. That's David Valadao, congressman in California, who's also highly vulnerable to a Democratic takeover because Biden won that district by double digits. That would mean that potentially the next Congress, if Liz Cheney, for example, were to lose in a couple weeks, there would be no Republicans who voted for Trump's impeachment in the House.
Oh, well, the political cost for that vote. Yep. Finally, Kansas, there's a proposed constitutional amendment on the abortion issue. Mm-hmm. This is the first such ballot measure in the country since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. What would it do?
Well, the Kansas Supreme Court had ruled previously that before Roe was overturned, that the Kansas Constitution enshrines the right to an abortion. This ballot measure is a little confusing because if yes wins on this ballot measure, that would mean that there would be no constitutional right to an abortion in the state and would open the door for changes to potentially having a more restrictive abortion law in the state, because it would move power to the state legislature, and the state legislature is controlled by a very conservative group of Republican congresspeople, or Republican state legislators, excuse me. Now, why this is important to the midterms is that if no wins or even comes close in a red state like Kansas, that tells you where the energy really is on the issue of abortion rights. It would confirm that, you know, a lot of what we've been seeing in the polls, that abortion rights are rising to the top for lots of voters and could be a motivating issue in these midterms that could blunt GOP gains in the House and help Democrats hold on to the Senate potentially.
Wow. Domenico Montanaro is watching the entire country for us. He is NPR senior political editor and correspondent. Thanks for the time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Insurrectionist Guy Reffitt, who never entered the Capitol on January 6th, but was charged with leading a mob to its doors, breaking police lines, was sentenced yesterday to a little over 7 years in prison, the longest sentence to date, as the Justice Department prosecutes hundreds of cases of rioters who attempted to block election certification in 2020. Reffitt refused a plea deal, called himself a martyr and a patriot, but in the sentencing, the judge said of him and others that day, not only are they not patriots, they are a direct threat to our democracy. Divisions in the Reffitt family mirror those in the country. His son Jackson famously tipped off the FBI to his dad's militia plans and said today he feels his father is mentally ill. After the sentencing, Reffitt's wife, Nicole, spoke to the press and doubled down.
We are patriots. Guy was a patriot that day. He'll consent. He will always be a patriot.
Reffitt's daughters had a different perspective.
To mark my dad as this horrible person and then having him prosecuted like this when somebody is maybe even able to get elected again doesn't seem right to me. Trump deserves life in prison if my father's in prison for this long.
What about those who directed the mob, others in the mob? Andrea Bernstein co-hosts the podcast Will Be Wild, words from then-President Trump's tweet about January 6th. She takes a deep dive into that day. And so, Andrea, you know, we know prosecutors wanted much more time for Reffitt. Reffitt's lawyers wanted less. Your thoughts?
Despite the fact that it is significantly less than prosecutors had initially asked for, it is the longest sentence of any January 6th defendant so far, and one that I think will send a signal.
What the court is saying is you are as guilty if you instructed or led. Well, that perhaps is one reason why he got this sentence, but why else? Because we know that his family and friends were sending letters about how he had been abused as a child, how he lost his job and then lost his way. But, you know, if he didn't attack an officer or enter the Capitol, why do you think he's such a symbol?
For a couple of reasons. I think one is the defiance with which he approached the trial. He did bring a weapon to the Capitol. He had a pistol. He threatened his children afterwards. But also prosecutors had said during the trial that he really was the tip of the spear. And if you look at the videos that day, you do see him leading a crowd up the steps in the Capitol.
People remember it was his son testifying about what his father did and cooperating with the FBI.
Our podcast, Will Be Wild, begins with the story of Jackson Reffitt, who at the time was 18 years old, overheard his father planning something strange, and got so worried that he Googled how to tip the FBI, and he did reach out to the FBI. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the FBI didn't respond to his tip until the afternoon of January 6th. Guy Reffitt was convicted of very serious felony charges. He was defiant. His wife, Nicole, had been defiant after he was convicted. And at the 11th hour, he decided to say he was sorry. It did seem the judge wasn't having it.
Well, meantime, just talk a little bit about where Reffitt had been held. He was in jail in Washington, D.C. for 19 months with a whole group of accused insurrectionists, all in the same unit. They played games and sang the national anthem together every night. What's your sense of why that happened? I mean, it would seem like it would harden them in their ideology.
Well, prison officials had said they had done this for security reasons, that they had separated January 6th defendants in this way. And for us, one of the things the jailhouse grouping was symbolic of is something that has happened in the country since January 6th, which is people from different extremist groups have connected with each other. And very soon after January 6th, as we began to speak to terrorism experts, domestic terrorism experts, Homeland Security officials, all of them expressed a concern that January 6th was the beginning of something, not the end, that it was a day when people came together versus the last chapter of the Trump administration. People came together by following the words of the former president on January 6th and going to the Capitol and fighting like hell.
And one of those people who cites Donald Trump's words is Danny Rodriguez. He's one of the insurrectionists. We all know the police officer, Michael Fanone. And he was the one who was pulled out into the crowd, beaten. He cries out, "I have children." He gets tased by Danny Rodriguez. And now Danny Rodriguez, in this portion of your podcast, Will Be Wild, is kind of crying during this questioning by the FBI, lamenting, you know, what he thought he was doing. Let's listen.
We thought we were being a part of a bigger thing. We thought we were being used as a part of a plan to save the country, to save America, to save the Constitution and the election, the integrity.
Like the ends justify the means kind of thing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
so
we thought
it was okay to do something wrong or illegal.
Yeah, it's like they cheated with Trump and they did all the elections. They're like, "Oh, Trump is so bad, where anything is okay."
You were prepared to give up your life to prevent him from being president?
No, to save the country.
So you thought you were going to martyr yourself for the cause of the country?
I'm so stupid.
Again, Danny Rodriguez, who also, it's so chilling, Andrea. You know, he talks to the FBI, and you have all these tapes in your podcast. Not only did he go to the Capitol, but he trained with a militia, the 3%ers, the same militia as Guy Reffitt. He talks about going out shooting with them and doing drills with them. They were preparing for civil war.
Yeah, I mean, there's still more to learn about the group of people that Danny Rodriguez trained with. But one of the things that's clear is Danny Rodriguez is somebody who was a longtime supporter of Donald Trump, who saw himself, particularly during the summer of 2020, when Black Lives Matter protests were sweeping the country, as someone who, from his, Danny Rodriguez's perspective, he was defending police officers. He was defending the blue against the protesters. And the FBI agents asked him in this interview, "How did you go from being that guy, the guy that was backing the blue, to a guy who put a taser onto the neck of a police officer and pulled it twice?" And I think that is sort of one of the keys to what happened in this country, is that Danny Rodriguez really explains how he followed the orders of former President Trump, how he went to Washington because Trump asked him to, how he went to the Capitol because Trump asked him to, because he believed, from listening to Trump and from listening to all the disinformation and misinformation from InfoWars to Fox News, that was telling people that the election results were stolen.
Let's listen. Again, insurrectionist Daniel Rodriguez talking to the FBI.
It's a lot of emotions when you get involved, when you feel like you're fighting evil. And you have a lot of fire that gets lit inside you. You can only, like, take so much before you start to, like, feel responsible for not doing something.
On January 6th, did you feel it was your responsibility?
I did. I thought that... Yes. I don't know. I didn't think it was going to turn out like this. I thought the good guys are, where the good guys were going to win. I thought I was a good guy. Wanted to be a good guy.
Yeah. Rodriguez thought he was being one of the good guys. More than 300 people still face felony counts. And you see this as a pyramid at the base. Most of those arrested have these low-level charges, next level up, a smaller, more dangerous group of people. They brought weapons. They attacked police. The top level, we understand that the Department of Justice is investigating Trump himself.
Certainly, the former president is still promulgating the big lie. And it's still being sent out through this very large echo chamber, the exact kind of echo chamber that Danny Rodriguez said motivated him to go to the Capitol and to pull out a taser on a police officer. And so long as the big lie has powerful adherence behind it, experts on disinformation say, we're still going to be confronting its effects. So there may be a group of people who went to the Capitol who are defiant. Some of them have been jailed. Others of them have been sentenced.
Some are running for office.
And, you know, some are writing books. But I think the larger question is, what do people think about the integrity of the electoral system? This sense of elections are not something to be trusted. I do think what we heard in this episode, which looked both at Danny Rodriguez and at Officer Mike Fanone, is in a way on January 6th, they sort of switched places. Here was Officer Fanone, who had felt during the summer of 2020, the Black Lives Matter protest, that law enforcement was under attack. And when he was at the Capitol on January 6th, trying to fend off this mob with spears and bear spray and all kinds of weapons. He's trying to fend them off. Medieval combat, he calls them. Those people are the existential threat. And for Danny Rodriguez, it was the opposite move. He had felt like law enforcement was his friend until he found himself in this position, which he admits is crazy, where to do what the president told him to do, he said, he was at almost mortal odds with the cops that he said he'd come to defend. Mm.
Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the podcast Will Be Wild. We'll link you to it at herenow.org. She's also author of the book American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. Andrea, thank you.
It's always great to talk to you, Robin.
When I say, name an area you'd be lucky to have invested in, what comes to mind? Well, probably not coal. But this polluting fossil fuel is on its way back to levels to use of almost a decade ago, thanks in part to a spike in energy demand after the height of the pandemic. Let's flush this out with Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
I'm fine, but coal? I mean, you know, weren't coal plants shutting down, replaced with natural gas? What's going on?
The problem is, I think, that natural gas has become the industry standard, at least in the United States, where we have autonomy. We are sitting on oceans and oceans of this stuff, what with the fracking boom of the past 15 years. Europe and other developing economies are not so lucky. They're not autonomous. And when Vladimir Putin puts his thumb on the pipes and slashes distribution of this stuff, they have to fall back on what they have. Nuclear is kind of taboo, and coal, even though these are rusted plants, they've been mothballed, you could get some emergency capacity out of them to the extent you need the air conditioners running in the summer and with a lot of dread facing the winter in Europe.
Yeah, we know Germany picked up coal production after Russia slowed its natural gas flow to Europe. And now the International Energy Agency expects global coal consumption to go back to 2013 levels. That's a 1% rise just this year. But, you know, do you think this is permanent?
I think the problem here is that nobody has truly put a kind of a sin tax on coal, a carbon tax on it. It's like when gasoline prices plummet in an economic collapse in the United States, and people go back to their own ways, their old ways. They buy SUVs, they buy big trucks, they start guzzling all over again until, you know, supply is out of whack again, and you have to deal with $4 or $5 price gasoline. And that's happening right now with coal, which we thought was kind of at a a terminal value. It kind of went the way of the carburetor or the milkman. Mm. But it came back because there's no fallback for baseload capacity. You could talk about renewables left and right, but they're not 24/7, especially when the world is getting hotter and hotter. And so these countries are desperate, and coal was there.
Yeah. And we also have to throw in that, you know, people weren't doing that much during the height of the pandemic. And then suddenly they all came back and there was this demand. Look, Robin, this is terrible for the environment, terrible for the health of coal workers, you know, still getting black lung
That's right.
disease and should be guided towards healthier industries. But, you know, the fact that we're using coal means that the climate situation is being made worse by that coal. It's even harder for people to meet goals to slow climate change. It's a pretty vicious cycle.
And look, Europe is supposed to be climate forward. As I said, this stuff is taboo. And, you know, 2011, nuclear was getting a lot of attention before Fukushima, that this was the better bridge from natural gas, which used to say, well, it's half as carbon intensive. But coal really takes us back decades.
Yeah. And coal prices for power generation are through the roof because coal, you know, the coal industry in the U.S. especially, has kind of shut down. They, you know, they can't even meet
some of the
demand. Yeah,
they're not taking this stuff out of the earth, but developing economies still are, and it's been sitting in piles. And coal prices are up about 170% in less than a year. As you said, who would have thought to start this year that that would have been the standout investment globally?
So in 2 seconds, maybe a little higher price as we head into the colder winter months?
Yeah, unfortunately. You know, renewables are going to take time to bring online.
Yeah. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks as always.
Thank you. My pleasure.
California firefighters this week expect at long last to contain the Oak Fire. It has been threatening giant sequoias near Yosemite National Park. Across the West, fires fueled by climate change are burning hotter and more frequently. Our next guest studies the rings inside trees for messages about climate, rain, and drought over centuries. Daniel Griffin is professor of geography and environment at the University of Minnesota. Professor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
First of all, when you heard, saw how the sequoias were threatened, what went through your mind?
Wow, the alarm bells went off for me. Of course, anyone who's had a chance to visit giant old trees like those in Yosemite, like those sequoias, carries it with them, I believe. And it's really a humbling experience to be there amongst those giants.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about your work and your scholarship. For years, you've studied Douglas fir trees at Mount Pinos. That's further south in California in Ventura County. First of all, what do tree rings look like, and what are they telling you about rain and drought?
Sure. So conifer tree rings in much of the western U.S. look just like the things that I think school children think about with respect to tree rings. You've got these annual bands of light growth produced in the spring and dark growth produced in the summer, and that couplet is the annual ring, and they form a series of concentric circles around one another. And so as they grow one per year, they encode a history in certain places of their environment and the climate conditions. And we can read those records year by year and decade by decade and century by century. And so I'm one of a growing number of scientists who specialize in reading environmental history from tree rings. Mm-hmm. And it's an easy to understand tool for environmental research. You can pick the data up and look at it. It's a really kind of potent visual medium. So over the last 20 years, I've been working in old growth forests across the American Southwest. I'm talking about California, Arizona, New Mexico. And on the landscape, the signs of change are increasingly and clearly visible. So we're seeing many trees die. We're seeing landscape scale mortality of trees, particularly the conifers in the mountain regions. And then when we bring our samples back to the lab, we're seeing in certain extreme years, very little, if any, growth during the worst years of this ongoing drought episode, now in its 22nd year.
And when you look at this current drought, you can zoom back with your ecological history book here, right, with these tree rings. Visually, how does now compare to some of the worst droughts hundreds of years ago?
visually, it does stand out. We'll see, in some cases, very scant evidence of growth for extreme years. And we saw that in earlier drought episodes, like this 20-plus year mega drought during the late 16th century. We saw that there, too. But they're really piling up. There's a higher frequency of these microscopic or locally absent rings in the ongoing drought. And what really makes this drought different is, yes, we're having low rainfall and precipitation. We're having a lot of years of that. In places like California, we have had wet years interspersed in there. But what's different now is the continuous run of very high temperatures, in many cases, record high temperatures. And so in the case of this 21st century mega drought, it's lower than average rainfall. The impact of that rainfall deficit is compounded by higher than really we've seen in a long time temperatures.
So when you draw inferences as to what's going on, what comes to mind? In some cases, there's what scientists call natural variability. This current mega drought seems like there might be more going on.
Exactly, Scott. So paleoclimatology is the study of climate in the period before we had good records from rain gauges and thermometers and other types of weather observing instruments. And scientists in this field have been focused on understanding how climate has changed in the past. Because I think most people realize, yeah, climate changes. It varies from year to year and decade to decade. And with paleoclimatology, we actually know a lot about it. We know how climate has varied in the past, where it has varied in the past. And much more importantly, Scott, we know why climate varied in the past. It also allows us to make a distinction about the way the climate is changing now. It really is different than it was in the past. And the science is really fairly settled at this point. There's not a lot of ambiguity. We've got these record high temperatures that are the result of human activities. I'm specifically talking about the burning of coal and gas and fossil fuels. And to put it frankly, we have spiked the climate system, releasing heat-trapping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere faster than any time in over 50 million years, the scientists tell us. And so that has pretty substantial implications for what we might expect going forward in the future, where we expect to continue to see climate variability like we had in the past, including years of intense drought. But we expect to see the climate changes stacking on top of that. This is the idea that we're loading the dice, is a phrase that we're hearing a lot. So more frequent and intense extreme events.
Professor, you also study blue oak trees, which can live more than 500 years. They hardly need any water. And recently you have seen, I guess, more trees that are in pretty poor health at low elevations. But what I found interesting in your article was your team didn't even dare take a chainsaw out to take samples from some of these trees?
Yeah, that's all correct. Blue oak is one of the most drought-adaptive trees that lives in California. And part of the way we get further back in time is by using the chainsaw to cut dead wood. And we're able then to match up the kind of barcode patterns of wide and narrow rings and figure out when the trees were growing. And the fire risk has been so severe the last few years, we dare not risk that. I mean, if you have an unexpected spark that ignites a wildfire, you've got a world of trouble.
And with these blue oaks, given how hardy they are and their ability to grow, to survive with hardly any water, how do you react when you see even these kind of trees struggling?
Well, I was taken aback last year, Scott. I mean, for many, many years, we've seen conifer mortality across the mountains of the West, in Colorado, in Arizona, New Mexico, California. But this was the first year, last season in 2021, where I noticed what seemed to be landscape scale decline of trees in the oak woodland. And this is particularly confined to the driest sites at really low elevation. But it was quite disconcerting. Yeah. So I should say just a little bit of optimism is that all of the trees are seem to be dying. And in fact, at the lowest elevations, we see some trees that seem to be having a very difficult time. And I'm talking about canopies where leaves did not emerge. And it looks almost like the trees are dead. And right next to those trees might be another tree of similar size and shape and apparent age. And they seem to be quite a bit more healthy. And so one of the things we're doing currently is trying to understand what's going on there. You know, there's clearly some drought adaptive traits. And so there's a lot more to learn. And the story's not yet fully told.
Yeah, yeah. Finally, Professor, you're a scientist. I gather it's a dendrochronologist who studies climate through trees and tree rings. But as a person who looks at nature through this long, long sweep of time, when you see this change happening, how do you process this? How do you talk about this with regular people, with us?
Well, it's obvious that I love trees, and I do want to save the trees, especially the elder trees and the ancient trees, who frankly deserve more respect than they have often been afforded in our consumptive society. But really, it's about more than just saving the trees. I'm a dad, I'm a girl dad, and like my daughter said just this week, "Dad, we need the trees. They help us." And she's right.
Daniel Griffin studies climate and ecosystem change at the University of Minnesota. Professor Griffin, thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you, Scott.
Are you an Instagram user? If so, you've probably noticed changes to the app, changes that a lot of users find unwelcome. Instagram now pushes short videos posted by people you don't even follow, and so does Facebook. Both are trying to keep up with the king of short videos, that would be TikTok. Let's talk about this with Callie Huang. She's reporting on this as a fellow for the New York Times. Welcome, Callie.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so my daughter is a religious user of Instagram for the photo. She's a photographer. And now it has all these videos from strangers? I mean, what has the reaction from Instagram users been to this?
Yeah, so Instagram has been pretty vocal about pivoting to video and video being the future of the platform. And so last week it started rolling out a few updates that really prioritized video on the app. And that has received a lot of user backlash, including from some of the platform's most prominent users. So Kylie Jenner, Kim Kardashian, who are the third most followed and the seventh most followed users on the app.
Yeah, millions of followers.
Exactly. They both posted on their stories about making Instagram Instagram again and telling the platform basically to stop being like TikTok or stop trying to resemble TikTok.
And what does the anger look like? I mean, is this kind of widespread unhappiness as best you can tell?
Yeah. So widespread, in fact, that the app later last week said that it would walk back some of its updates. It said that it would stop doing tests of full screen photos and videos, which were introduced to replace posts that would just take up a portion of the screen. And it also said that it would decrease the number of recommended posts from their algorithm. So those would be posts from people you don't follow.
We have a little bit of audio on the response from Instagram. Here's Instagram head Adam Mosseri and his post to his feed recently.
Now, I want to be clear. We're going to continue to support photos. It's part of our heritage. You know, I love photos. I know a lot of you out there love photos too. That said, I need to be honest. I do believe that more and more of Instagram is going to become video over time.
So, Callie, this does not sound like corporate penance. Okay, customers, we heard you. We're going to go back to the original stick shift VW Beetle. You know, I mean, it sounds like we're still going in the direction we want to go in.
Right, exactly. So although Instagram has walked back some of these updates, it's made it pretty clear that these are sort of temporary pauses in these tests. It's only temporary that, for example, we'll get our normal feed and the decrease in the number of recommended posts, again, temporary.
So there's this tension here, it seems like. Maybe that has to deal with social media in general. On the one hand, you have these huge influencers, right, Kylie Jenner, et cetera, who want things the way they are. And then there's this future moving quickly, you know, where the eyeballs are going, what the data show, where the advertisers are following. So for social media companies in general, how do they balance these two and still stay relevant?
I think social media platforms are trying to figure out exactly what you just said. TikTok is hugely popular and has become a big competitor for people's attention. And last week, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO and founder of Meta, formerly known as Facebook, has said that they were also moving forward with more suggested content and more videos on Facebook as well. And so although users and social media influencers might not be happy, these adjustments are sort of a response to where user attention is going.
Now this isn't the first time we've heard of this pivot to video concept, right? Inspired by data from Facebook, several media companies tried this back in 2015, 2016. Back then, it was seen as largely a failure that Facebook was overestimating the average viewing time for video ads on the app. Could this be another miscalculation this time? Or do you think the world has changed?
We're quite different now than we were in 2015. I mean, TikTok, again, is really highly popular, and it's being used by a really coveted segment of the population, by younger folks. And so whether this new pivot to video pans out, I think remains yet to be seen, but Reels and other video products are driving user growth and engagement.
Okay. And finally, just briefly, is there any indication that people are leaving Instagram because they're unhappy?
So when Instagram walked back their updates, they said that it was in response to their findings and community feedback, so sort of tangible results of rolling out these tests. And I think the question sort of is, if the user experience on one app largely resembles the user experience on another app, what makes a user want to stay on Instagram versus TikTok? That, I think, is part of the reason why Instagram walked back some of their updates.
All right, more to follow, more to watch going forward. Kelly Huang is a technology reporting fellow for The New York Times. Thanks, Kelly, for the time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. This is Here and Now.